It's a full moon.
Beware the moon and stick to the road. Oops.
Welcome to Horror Camp.
This is Horror Camp 2, Camper's Revenge. Once again, I'm your host, Daniel, and for those new to camp, this podcast is dedicated to all things horror. That's the good, the bad, creepy, kooky, gory, gritty, queer, and the camp. In this episode, I'm actually going to be joined by Mike, where we'll discuss the recent Oz HorrorCon, and there's a few little meet-and-greet interviews from some stallholders at Oz HorrorCon as well. Later in the episode, I'll be joined by another guest, Lee, and together we're going to be looking at the successes and failures of the horror movie sequel. We're also going to take a rather in-depth look at one particular sequel, pretty much the worst sequel of all time, but it's also the gayest sequel of all time, and that is none other than Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge. But first, let's jump into horror news.
Consistent reports from witnesses to the effect that people who acted as though they were in a kind of trance were killing and eating their victims prompted authorities to examine the bodies of some of the victims. Medical authorities in Cumberland have concluded that in all cases, the killers are eating the flesh of the people they murdered.
Okay, so last year it actually got announced that NBC will be producing a new TV series of Dracula. So production has actually started now, and the TV series is going to be starring Jonathan Rhys-Meyers as the lead role of Dracula, and it's actually being produced by the team behind the highly successful Downton Abbey. The concept for this show has actually been described as a combination of Dangerous Liaisons meets the Tudors. So it's going to be interesting to sort of see how this one pans out. It's set in London in the late 19th century, and basically the story follows Dracula posing as an American entrepreneur, and he's intent on bringing modern science to Victorian England. Of course, being Dracula, his actual intention is a far darker one, and it's all set on a revenge plot, but basically. It's also been announced that we've got Katie McGrath, who was from Merlin. She's going to be playing the role of Lucy. We've also got Jessica DeGaulle, who was from the TV series Arrow, and she's going to be playing the role of Mina, which will be interesting. We've also got Nonzo Anozie, I think that's how you pronounce his name, and he was from Game of Thrones, and he's going to be playing the role of Renfield. So, look, it's a bit of a mixed cast. It's going to be interesting to see how this one pans out, but I also found out it's got Dan Knuth, I believe is how you pronounce his name. He was actually the creator behind the HBO series Carnival. Now, anyone out there who watched Carnival would know that that was an incredibly darkly dreamy atmospheric TV show, so I'm really hoping his influence as a creative role is going to take effect with this TV series. The first series has actually been given the go-ahead for 10 episodes, so looking forward to seeing what comes out of that one. Also, in the past week, we had the team at ZombieHire.com launched their very first Labyrinth Outbreak event, and it seems it actually came together as a fantastic success. Just hearing people raving about the adventure that was the Labyrinth Outbreak. Basically, the concept behind this is there's 30 people head into a labyrinth at night, armed only with headlamps and a mobile phone. Their mobile phone gets sent text messages giving them little missions they have to achieve, and in the labyrinth is a whole bunch of zombies. The idea is, in the middle of the labyrinth, there is the one cure, so out of 30 people, only one person is guaranteed to live. Fantastic concept, really, really cool, and the team at ZombieHire.com are really quite outstanding with the level of professionalism they put into their makeup, their costuming, and also their performance as well. I'm actually going to be catching up with some of the team from Zombie High in a few weeks' time just to sort of have a further discussion about some other events they've got coming up this year, and also just talking a bit more about sort of zombie effects and makeup and so forth. So looking forward to that one. Now, at the movies, it's been a little quiet of late, with the release of Mama actually has been pushed back from February to mid-March here in Australia, so that's a little frustrating. So pretty much the only horror-esque thing that we've got coming to the cinemas in the next few weeks is actually Hansel and Gretel. Now, look, Hansel and Gretel to me, just going from the previews, it really just reeks of Van Helsing 2004 to me. I'm not a huge fan of over-the-top CGI popcorn, but look, who knows, I might give it a go. But that's pretty much it at the moment. So without further ado, let's get into camp. So joining me now on Horror Camp, I have our guest Mike.
Hi.
So, Mike and I attended Oz HorrorCon 13 a few weekends back, and let's jump straight into it. So, Mike, what did you think of Oz HorrorCon?
I actually really loved it. Like, the setup was great, the range of things there was really fun to just go around and see everything from, like, the gore effects stalls to... I mean, I'm a comic book geek, so actually seeing the horror comics there was just awesome, because I didn't even know we had Australian-based horror comics.
That was it, and there was a really good representation of some of the Oz horror comics. So Decay comic was one that really was quite a standout, I think, there as well. And, of course, Paul Bedford was there, the writer of The List graphic novel. So they're two key comics that really did sort of jump out to me. What else was it about the event that sort of jumped out to you?
First off, the cosplayers.
Yeah.
First thing I stepped in, because I saw a couple of people doing the zombie thing outside. Yeah. I think there were some of the Zombie Hire guys as well.
Yeah, we had zombiehire.com. They provided a zombie for the 2 days.
But yes, just seeing, like, we had a Freddy, we had there was a Cenobite, there are a couple other guys there who just went for it. And just, yeah, I'm used to seeing the cosplay thing at the normal cons, but actually seeing the horror con take on it and people really getting into that as well was really fun, and not just the generic zombie either.
Yeah, I was also, with the cosplay, it was really exciting to see a real mixed bag of horror icons. You had your classic Jasons and Freddy there, but there was some original zombie-esque characters there as well, which was really, really cool. And actually, judging the cosplay competition was really good to see the special guests. So we had PJ Souls, who was a special guest for the weekend, and she, for listeners out there, may know her from Halloween and also from Carrie. We also had Shane Bryant, who is one of the old guard of Hammer Horror Productions, and he was quite famously known for being in The Picture of Dorian Gray and Frankenstein and the Monster from Hell. And we also had Leslie Simpson from Dog Soldiers, The Descent, and Crawl Space, which is coming out soon as well. So, the cosplay was really, really cool, and I enjoyed the competition of them getting up there and doing their little presentation pieces.
Oh, yes.
I thought that was pretty cool. We did have Arvi from Of Science and Swords do his Dark Lord little monologue, which was rather humorous and a lot of fun. What did you think about the setup of the space itself?
Oh, look, the downstairs section in the cellars of the pub was amazing.
Yeah.
Like, nicely atmospheric, really just good vibe to the area. And enough space for the stalls down there. It was great. Upstairs was a little odd just for me, walking in where it was everything nicely clean and white and very open and not a lot of content up there as well.
Look, I kind of agree with the spacing of that. I love downstairs. It was very atmospheric, and originally the whole event was to be held downstairs, and it was rather last minute that Oz HorrorCon did get access to the upstairs area, which was their benefit, because there was over 35 different stalls and presenters there, so it was quite a large event. But with the upstairs space, I guess working against it was it was so large, really, really high ceilings, really stark white, and it would have taken a lot to really sort of jazz up that place to really set an atmosphere.
It was just so light and airy. It was like an oversized room in the Cube or something.
Yeah. So I think first walking in for that space was a little, little odd. But as soon as you step downstairs, I feel that's where you fully captured the atmosphere.
And just the whole, like, the twisting and turning and never being quite sure what you're going to find when you go around the corner or through the archway. It was almost very kind of Victorian London in the way.
It was
which was great.
Yeah, and also, like, the back stairs that you follow up and then before you know it, you're back in the main space. It was this little maze of horror, which I thought was fantastic for the setting, that part of it. So, out of the stands, what was your favourite?
Well, I did kind of get lost in amongst all the horror DVDs for about 20 minutes, half an hour at one point.
So we have Monster Pictures there, and we had Film Link there as well.
Monster Pictures were downstairs, and they had a lot of the real old school stuff. I was actually quietly squeeing while I was staying there, finding things like different parts of the Howling series and the Cabin of Dr. Caligari and all that kind of stuff, where you don't typically see it at, you know, video stores and stuff. You can find it online, but being able to find the DVDs in this dedicated horror section was just fantastic.
Yeah, and we also had a Popcorn Video there with a really cool stand full of rather hard to get and B-grade horror videos as well, which was really, really cool. For me, a standout really was the special effects and the gore stands. There was quite a few of them at Oz HorrorCon, but a true standout for me was actually the team from Nightshade Effects. The quality of their work was truly outstanding. They had a variety of different prosthetics there for sale as well. So there was severed fingers and hearts and skulls, and they just had a great feel to them, texture to them, and just the aesthetic was stunning.
Yeah, they had a real nice occult kind of lean to it as well, which is way more my taste. Like, it's great seeing the really zombie kind of brain splattery gore stuff, but the more slightly gothic, old agey look is just me to the ground. So the second I found their stall, I was kind of in love with everything there and didn't have enough money.
Yeah, that was it. We did spend a fair bit of money on that day and could have spent a lot more. But also having the special guest there was fantastic. And I did get to sit in on a few of the talks, and I got to sit in on Shane Bryant's talk, which was really, really wonderful. He could have talked, honestly, for hours and kept everyone entertained. But unfortunately, we only had him for a short period of time because he was doing an actual dinner event that evening where he was talking a lot more. Unfortunately, I couldn't attend that myself. Leslie Simpson was there talking and charming the audience, as always. And Aaron Stearns, who is co-writing Wolf Creek 2, was there. So it was really great because we got to get a little bit of an insight and a bit of a scoop as to what's a few things of what we can expect from Wolf Creek 2. And he's also writing the book, which is a prequel to Wolf Creek. And we got to hear a few pages out of that, which was really, really awesome.
I unfortunately missed out on that part, but I caught up with you when you came out. You were just bouncing from getting the sneak peek at what was going on with it. If your reaction is anything to go by, it's going to be good.
Yeah, look, horror fans were really delighted walking out of that. We're all really, really buzzing. For the next Oz HorrorCon, what would you like to see them do for the next one? What do you think they could bring to really step it up?
I would love to see more decoration. I mean, we went to the Fanboy versus Art Boy horror showing at their gallery, and they just did the space up like a murder scene. All the staff were wandering around dressed as crime techs or cleanup techs. They had splattered tissue paper and they had splattered plastic all over the walls, that kind of stuff. Yeah. And it just lent a different air to the space, that it wasn't just a building we're using. This is something that we're really setting up for it. And I really think that would have been cool to see that kind of stuff there as well. I mean, we don't need the cobwebs, all that kind of stuff, but just something which is really going to put you in the mood as you're wandering through that this is a horror convention. Just a step past just the basic architecture of the cellars kind of thing. That would be fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
Look, for me, Stephen did a fantastic job, and also obviously Jackie, who I know put in a lot of work behind the scenes too with making this happen. For the next one, look, I'd be very excited to see a few more sort of demonstrations of prosthetics and a bit more behind the scenes of gore and maybe some hands-on workshops as well. Yeah. Having a look at makeup artistry, gore creation, shooting a scene of a horror film, even a short story workshops being run by maybe the Australian Horror Writers Association. Yeah. Different things like that to really get us interacting to that next level. I knew Stephen mentioned previously that he was looking at the idea of like a haunted house and things like that, which is quite large and amazing. But I think the direction that it's actually ended up heading towards, which was more interactive with the audience hands-on, I think that direction is a lot more effective and really connecting with the people that that are going there.
Oh yeah, and I think that's also with any con, you've got that certain point where you're all customers coming in.
Yeah.
With a small place like that, the horror community is fervent in Australia.
Yeah.
It's not ginormous yet.
Yeah.
So you've got this small community coming in. You can really get them involved and get the fans pumping with stuff happening in a convention as opposed to trying to go someplace like Supernova or Armageddon where huge layouts, so much stuff going on. A lot of the time you're basically consuming or sitting there listening to someone talk.
Yeah.
This is the chance to actually get into horror and make it your own.
And that's it, and I think that's part of the charm that Stephen's really created there with Oz HorrorCon, and I'd like to see that side of it grow. Well, let's listen to a few little interviews that we captured on the day. Still yet to see sort of how the sound quality was of this, because it was a bit loud in some of the areas, but we'll do our best. So here's a few of the stall holders at Oz HorrorCon.
Hello, Horror Camp listeners. Now, I'm here at Oz HorrorCon, and I'm joined here by Darren, the Managing Director of Dark Oz, and they produce a graphic novel called DK. So, welcome to camp, Darren.
Hello, how's it going?
Now, this is a pretty impressive-looking collection you've got here, DK graphic novel. For those listeners out there who haven't picked up a copy yet, can you tell us a little bit about what's behind DK?
Oh, for sure. Well, I'd say it's more of a comic book than a graphic novel.
Yeah.
There's 14 issues out so far. It's an anthology of short stories. Every issue contains fully self-contained short stories. You can buy any one issue without having the others. They don't flow on, they're just all one-offs.
Wonderful. And there's some fantastic artwork in this as well. It's a combination of some of them are in colour, some in black and white. Now, you're one of the writers as well of the works?
That's correct. I write quite a few of the stories, yeah.
Fantastic. So what inspires your writing of horror comics?
It's something I've always wanted to do. I've got a lot of ideas. They just come to me sometimes.
Yeah.
And I've got notebooks full of ideas I've written. Every time I have a story idea, I make a note, get around to it sometime later. And there's aside from what you see here, there's dozens of stories out there in the works, not just for me, but other writers as well, with other artists drawing, illustrating our stories for us.
Awesome. So out of all the stories that you've written so far, which would be your favourite and what is it about it that really sort of kicks to the heart of what you do?
Probably my best writing is The Memory Remains.
Okay, and what's that about?
It's about a guy who's immortal. He's living with a village of people, and one night in his sleep they just cut him to pieces, but unlike Highlander, when his head gets cut off, he's still actually alive, so his head is just stuck on a stake.
Awesome.
He can't move because he's got no body. He can't even talk because he's got no lungs to push air through his mouth. And he's just sitting, his head is just on this stake, still alive, looking around in agony as they crack his skull open and start eating his brains.
Wow, that's really cool.
It is actually fairly disturbing and also a very sad story. So,
if listeners out there wanted to find DK, the comic, whereabouts can they find you?
In Melbourne, you can buy it at Minotaur.
Yep.
Otherwise, look up Dark Oz online, www.darkoz.com. .com.au.
Yep.
And you can buy the comic on the website using PayPal.
Yep.
And also there's a list of their shops all around Australia where you can buy it.
Fantastic. Look, listeners, this is a great collection and really fantastic Australian art and Australian writers. So get behind them and support it. Thank you very much, Darren.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Okay, now I'm here with Avi of Science and Swords. So tell us a little bit about Science and Swords itself, Avi.
Well, Science and Swords is a sci-fi and fantasy bookstore where we try to specialize in a lot of the more obscure things, independent authors, older titles, golden classics, and generally speaking, stuff that you would have difficulty acquiring at a Dimmicks or even online.
Awesome, awesome. Now, you've got a very impressive range of horror bits and pieces here. Like, I was actually surprised at the amount of actual horror literature you have, as well as the sort of toys and bits and pieces.
Well, I'm actually a horror literature buff myself, like crap horror such as Stephen King, which he'll admit it's dime store stuff, whereas, you know, like there's plenty of really quite creepy horror authors out there, such as Brian Lumley, or, you know, middle of the range stuff, Joe Donnelly. I like it all. It's a guilty pleasure in amongst the George R. R. Martins and the J.R.R. Tolkien. Anyone who's got R.R. as their middle initials, really. So we specialize not just in sci-fi and fantasy, but also in horror that breaches into sci-fi and fantasy. So we also have Clive Barker, as I mentioned, Brian Lumley, all of that sort of stuff, because it does go into that zone. We also like to pride ourselves on having one of the best selections of Cthulhu literature.
For those people out there that want to find out a little bit more about Of Science and Swords, whereabouts can they find you?
Best place to really find us is on our Facebook page, because we're very interactive. We like to answer questions as soon as possible and also post a lot of entertaining content. So if you just head on to facebook.com/scienceandswords, all as one word, you'll be able to find us fairly easily.
Fantastic. And if people did have some rather obscure novels out there that they were seeking, would you be able to help them with that?
Oh, generally speaking, not a problem. You may have to pay a bit more than shelf price, but to date, the best find that we've managed to get someone was a second edition Jules Verne.
Wow.
So
that's impressive.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now I'm here with Dale from Nightshade Effects. So Dale, you've got one impressive table of prosthetics and interesting work here. So tell us a little bit about Nightshade Effects.
Basically, we founded in September 2005. We're a husband and wife team.
Yeah.
So Emily McGregor and myself. Basically, just to cater for short films, we grab a handy cam with all our old friends, just making sort of things on the weekends. And it just became, instead of like I wouldn't even call it a passion, I'd call it obsession. Or a way of life, it just sort of took over everything.
Awesome.
Like, you'd skip work just to make a movie. You didn't want to have anything to do with the real world. It's just making films, making art. Just kept going and going and going until one day I'm like, you know what? I don't want to live in the real world at all anymore. I just want to take this the next step. So I sent a resume off to my now good friend Justin Dix of Wicked Love Studios. Got to work on Red Hill with him, and the rest is kind of history. We just launching our first range here of all horror props and whatnot.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Look, the quality is absolutely fantastic. So, we've got some really cool Severed Fingers, Hearts, we've got Skull Casts here. So what is your favourite prosthetic to make, and what is it about it that you enjoy?
To be honest, I like it all.
Yeah.
Skulls are my thing.
Yeah.
I really like... ever since I was a kid, I used to, fossil for dinosaur bones and things like that. Found a few, and awesome. Just obsessed with bones. Bones are my thing.
Yeah.
In terms of gore, I really like organs.
Okay.
So hearts, things that, because I do sculpting and all that, I don't like sculpting sort of normal things. I like going back to history and looking at Renaissance ones, how they used to study it as an anatomical sort of structure rather than something just to freak you out.
Yep.
So I really like... basing things in realism and things like that. So.
Cool.
Makes it a bit more extreme and confronting too as a prop.
So now I guess working in association with Wicked of Oz and Justin Dix, you're now getting involved with some larger film productions with your work?
Yeah, it's been a dream come true.
Yeah.
I can say a little kid from the country coming down to Melbourne and then get to work on a film set with like esteemed actors that I'm a fan of.
Yeah.
It's been amazing. So
Well, I dare say being in Australia, you've really hit
quite the goldmine of prosthetics and gore horror work.
Well, there, working with Justin is the goldmine, because my favourite film of all time is probably Empire Strikes Back. Uh-huh. And I know Dixie made R2 and 3PO in the new film, so it's heaven to work with this guy. And, and now we're good friends. He tells me all the goss of that Star Wars and that. So it's just incredible, man. It's
awesome. So, look, if people wanted to see more of your work and actually get in contact with you guys, where can they find you?
Best place is, at the moment, Facebook.
Yep.
Just Nightshade Effects on Facebook. But
Nightshade
Effects. We're launching our website. It'll be ready in about 2 weeks.
Fantastic.
And, or just get in contact with the studio, Wicked of Oz.
Wonderful. Well, look, listeners, if you're out there looking for maybe a heart or a severed finger or even a skull for the grandma, then these are the guys to definitely look up. So thank you very much.
No worries, thank you.
Now, I'm standing here with Brooke from Legume Man Books. So tell us a little bit about Legume Man.
Sure, Legume Man's a small press, and we basically publish anything horror, mainly extreme horror and unusual fiction, which is a little bit like Bizarro stuff, Absurda stuff, and things like that.
Awesome.
So, but our main focus this year has been a lot of horror books, and particularly Australian authors like Steve Gerlach, Brett McBean, R. Frederick Hamilton, trying to remember now, Andrew Gallagher, things like that. Wow. So we try and get some new authors and some already established authors, so they try and help each other out a little bit as well.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
So what do you see as being a bit of a trend at the moment coming through in the Australian horror writing scene?
Well, I'm seeing a lot of things that are tied to movies, like Buck and Jimmy Go West by Brett McBean is our latest book, and that's really tied to movies, and the main character in there, who's a serial killer and an utter psychopath, is also totally in love with films. So the whole book is surrounded by all of these film quotes and tie-ins to all sorts of different things, and then at the end of it, it's all about films. So that's a really cool thing that I'm seeing coming through all of our stories at the moment, is a lot of tie-ins with other media, I guess.
Awesome.
It's really cool. Yeah.
So if people wanted to get their hands on some absolutely awesome Australian horror books, whereabouts can they look for you guys?
Sure. So www.legumen.com is our website, and you can always go there. Notions Unlimited Bookstore, which is in Chelsea in Melbourne, holds all of our stock. And Amazon is the best place to buy them online. And we've also got ebooks of everything.
Wonderful. And do you guys have a Facebook or Twitter site that they can go to?
Yeah, we've got Facebook and Twitter, so you can follow us on either of those if you want to.
Okay, so Twitter would be @LegumeMan.
Yep. And Facebook would also be LegumeMan. Yep.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for your time.
Nice to meet you.
Now, I'm here with Paul Bedford of The List. So, Paul, tell us a little bit about The List.
Okay, let's see. I've written a crazy little book. I had an artist or two who were nice enough to draw up my crazy little book, and now I'm selling it.
Brilliant. Hey, that's it. Ladies and gentlemen, you heard it first. Paul Bedford, thank you. Now, word is, this book, this little graphic novel's been translated into what looks like to be a film script there.
Yeah, it sort of came about, left a field where I had friend of a friend of a friend told about the book, and they, grabbed the copy, and he's pretty well entrenched in the film industry. Mm-hmm. Just freshly returned from London, where he'd done quite a few things. And he read it and thought it was perfect for the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And passed it on to a producer/director over there who's quite well known, Academy Award nominated for a short, and has produced quite a few works. Had him read it, and then both of them together came to the conclusion that they wanted to option the rights.
Brilliant.
For the screenplay based on the graphic novel script. So they were nice enough to let me do the adaptation. I think nice enough. looking back, it's been pretty tough adapting my own work, but it's turning out quite well.
Awesome.
Turning out lovely. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
And if people wanted to get their hands on a copy of The List, which is an absolutely beautiful, beautiful graphic novel,
great story,
but the artwork is also absolutely stunning. Whereabouts can they check it out?
Okay, there's a couple of places. There's a Facebook group called The List Graphic Novel, if you're outside of Australia. Orders can be placed there. Within Australia, I've got it in a few stores, Melbourne, Canberra, and one in Queensland, whose name escapes me at the moment. But having not yet approached any real publishers, mm-hmm. It's all sort of off my own bat. So until we send it out this year... to all the to those who publish these things and distribute them worldwide, then pretty much online via Facebook and Minotaur. I think in Melbourne, Minotaur, Classic Comics,
All-Star Comics. All-Star Comics.
All-Star, of course, yeah, big supporters of the comic scene here, and of Science and Swords, which is a nice little geek haven.
Yeah. Brilliant. Oh, yeah. Wonderful. Thank you very much, Paul.
I need a beer.
Hello and welcome back to Horror Camp. Now I'm joined here by Lee. So thank you for coming on camp, Lee.
Not a problem.
Now, this is episode 2, so I thought that we'd spend this Horror Camp actually looking at the failures and successes that are the inevitable sequel. Jumping right in, what do you think is some of the dangers in horror movie sequels?
I guess some films try to immediately repeat the success of the first,
mm-hmm. yeah.
And don't necessarily add anything to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then some stray from the formula. Or maybe not the formula, but stray from the story and say, hey, you know that thing that you liked? How about we do something different?
That's
but
it.
Just give it the same name.
Well, isn't it one of the rules of Scream where they say, you know, don't fuck with the original? And that is one of the rules.
And look, a sequel is always going to fuck with the original.
That's it. My biggest issue is obviously just jumping on the bandwagon of the success of the first and not having enough creative time to formulate a second film. They just want to jump straight on to the make a franchise, get that money rolling, and pump out whatever the fuck they can.
Yes, as we've seen with, we were discussing earlier, Paranormal Activity.
Yes.
Which wasn't great to begin with. Difference of opinion, but like, yeah. So you can imagine how I feel about the four other sequels.
Look, I didn't mind the first one. I actually liked some of what they brought to the found footage genre of horror. But look, when it first came out, it was still brought something fresh and new. And then unfortunately, there was four films made out of that, and about to be five by this Halloween. God fucking help us. Anyway, I put the question out to the Horror Camp podcast Facebook group just to find out what your thoughts were out there. And we've got a few sort of interesting replies as to what people thought were good and bad follow-ups. So out of the bad, Halloween 3, definitely, Season of the Witch, came up as a rather consistent, that was fucking awful. Also, Seed of Chucky and the Child's Play follow-up. So, look, number 2 wasn't too bad, but by the time of number 3, it was pretty awful. And then you jump into, obviously, Bride of Chucky, and Seed of Chucky was just woeful.
Well, look, I'm not a fan of irony horror.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, that self-referential, we're aware that we're trying to scare you kind of horror that was big in the late 90s.
Nobody mentioned Exorcist 2?
No, Exorcist 2 was pretty awful. That wasn't in here. Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Next Generation. I have to agree with that. And now, Devil's Rejects came up in here. Now, you thought Devil's Rejects was a good follow-up?
I actually thought it was better than the original.
Yeah. The original being House of a Thousand Corpses. Yeah.
Which I found very over the top, unscary, unfunny.
Yeah, and I think Devil's Rejects was more set in a real world scenario. And
it was peeled back, and you know, you could see Rob Zombie honing his craft.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, for better or worse.
Well, yeah, that's it. He kind of did sort of throw everything he possibly could at the first one, that was for sure.
He tried too hard to be cool, and he tried too hard with the catchphrases and, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually heard someone mentioning that they thought the approach was that House of a Thousand Corpses was the fantasy perspective of what the killers were seeing themselves as, and then the second part actually being the reality.
Yeah.
So I thought, I've got to go back and watch with that sort of...
I prefer my theory that it was his first film and he was shit, and then he got a little better.
Gee, yeah. I think you might actually be onto something there. Now, what about positive ones? What do you think has been a successful follow-up film?
Well, I agree with the chat on Facebook. Dawn of the Dead would have to be the best sequel of any horror film ever, in that it equals and surpasses and extends on the first.
True, yeah.
So, you know, if that would be the criteria of what makes a great sequel, then that would be, in my opinion, the greatest.
Yeah, look, I'd have to agree with you, actually, there, because it doesn't retract from the first film. It doesn't put down or degrade anything that was achieved through that. It does take the concept and the world that it's built and develops further, and makes us engage a lot deeper into that world too by the second film.
Which and extends the themes to these socially wide rather than this sort of small ensemble piece, even though the second one is an ensemble piece as well. But, you know, you feel it's definitely outward looking.
A bigger world.
Yeah.
And, of course, Evil Dead 2 popped up as a bit of a favourite on the Facebook page as well.
Is it a sequel?
I know.
Is it, you know...
I don't know, like, I think Sam Raimi, again, was just really fucking with us there, going, you know what, I'm going to make the same film with more money and just tweak a few little bits and pieces. Now, like, it was a great film.
It's good.
It was really, really good. Yeah. Does it then meet the mark of going, did it detract from the first film?
No, but that would be hard to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is better than the first film.
Definitely, definitely.
But in terms of narrative...
Yeah.
Is it a sequel? It's kind of a sequel, but it's also kind of the same film, only more so.
Yeah. You know? It's funny, whether it's actually... Because they mess with your head throughout that film, so whether it is sort of this parallel timescape or parallel universe where you're reliving certain aspects of the story, but in a slightly different perspective, because you're dealing with demons of other dimensions and things like that, and... I almost take it as if, yes, it is a sequel, it is a different story, but messing with our heads, going, hold on, this is familiar, we've been this, but we can't change that.
I mean, there's quite a lot in Evil Dead 2 where you're seeing from Ash's perspective. Mm. And so in that sense, it's legitimized in the movie that some things can be surreal.
Yeah.
And so it is quite surreal. and not a, you know... Do I care if it fits in perfectly? Not really, because it's a better film. And it would be in my top 20 favourite horror films.
Yeah, oh, definitely, definitely. Now, having a look at some sequels here, we've got The Last Exorcism 2 about to come out.
Is this like the never-ending story part 2?
luckily they have called it The Last Exorcism Part 2. It's kind of how many fucking parts to the last of something are we going to have? So that's coming out this year.
Could have been the penultimate exorcism.
We've also got Insidious 2 is coming out.
I don't think I ever saw Insidious.
You didn't? Maybe I should sit you through Insidious and then we could discuss that, because I'm in two minds over Insidious personally. I actually did find some of the storytelling and some of the scripting really, really good, right on the money, some great scenes, and then all of a sudden towards the end, it just lost me. I just felt it went into this pantomime realm, and I just really completely lost all investment and took back all of my scares that it gave me.
I do remember hearing that it was a good film, and it was... Look, I don't know anything about it. So, maybe I should watch it because I haven't seen it. Yeah.
So, look, the sequel. So, here we are in our very own sequel. I thought, what better way to really jump into the theme that is horror camp by exploring one of the campest and gayest sequels in the horror film genre? And that would be Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge. Now... You've seen Freddy's Revenge?
I've seen it before, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How old were you when you first saw it?
Oh, I must have been maybe 11 or 12.
Okay.
Yeah. Renting it from the milk bar down the road from my nan's house.
Okay.
Didn't actually have a VHS player at my nan's house. I used to rent videos and then go to her neighbour's place and watch them.
Awesome. That would have been a great film to walk into your neighbour's house with.
Yeah, a bit awkward.
So, look, I saw it quite young as well, probably a similar age range. And I tell you what, I was pretty switched on with some films, with picking up some moments that I identified with as an emerging young gay man. But holy shitballs, the gayest horror film of all time.
Well, I have to admit, I was completely oblivious.
Oh, okay. Well, look, let's venture back into the nightmare that is the sequel.
Yeah.
And we'll come back after we've had a bit of a
see if it stirs any memories. You know, latent teen sexuality.
Okay.
Hey, what the fuck you doing in my room? Listen, I'm in trouble. I need you to let me stay here tonight.
Are you out of your mind? I killed Snyder.
You what? Only it wasn't me, see? There's something inside of me.
I think you are seriously losing it, bro.
I'm scared, Grady. Something is trying to get inside my body, and you want to sleep with me.
And we're back. So,
well, we're traumatized.
I don't quite understand how.
What happened?
Okay, so for anyone out there that hasn't seen Nightmare on Elm Street 2, first of all, go out there, hire it right now, and then come back and listen to the rest of this podcast, because it's going to be full of spoilers.
Is that necessary? Because I don't think the person who, or the people who made this, saw the first film.
No.
I think they also went down to the video shop, read the back, and made a sequel based on that. Based on the synopsis of the first.
It was fucking atrocious. Now, I actually have this on my list as one of the worst sequels of all time for horror films.
Yeah.
But it also, at the same time, is one of the gayest horror films ever made. So I've got this love-hate relationship with it.
It has gay themes that aren't subtext, more text.
That's it. And the horror genre, as I talked about on the Guy-Fi episode, all about subtext in horror films.
Yeah.
This one... No,
so Hellraiser, you could say, is a gay horror film that has, you know, unsubtle subtext, but it is subtext.
Fright Night as well, the original Fright Night, full of it. Even to a certain extent, Lost Boys. And then when you hark back to the original celluloid heroes, so looking at Bride of Frankenstein and Frankenstein, again, you've got elements within that. And then even in the early 50s, when you look at I Was a Teenage Werewolf and I Was a Teenage Frankenstein, and also the even gayer How to Make a Monster, all of those, very, very gay.
Yeah.
But subtext.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe it becomes a definitional... Is the definition of a gay horror film one that has gay characters in it, or a gay plot, you know... Or is it a certain sensibility, or is it a certain approach?
I think it's all encompassing. For me, you can have sort of in your face, literally in LA Zombie, which is basically a porn made with zombies.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've got sort of a step down from that, a horror film like Hellbent, which is full of gay characters.
I mean, the reason why I ask is because I just don't want to be associated with this film.
Look, it
I think this might be where homophobia comes from.
Well, look, let's just, for the viewers out there, let's just have a quick look at a plot summary of this. Basically, we're following the lead character of Jesse, who has moved into the house that Nancy lived in. So Nancy,
1428 Elm Street, I think is the number.
Yeah. So this is set 5 years after the original Nightmare on Elm Street, but it was actually made 2 years, 1 year after the original.
So technically sci-fi.
So yeah, because we're playing with time and space. Okay, so Jesse is a male character. And he's living in this house and is starting to have really terrifying dreams. And slowly he feels that Freddy is taking over him to the point where Freddy actually comes out of his body in the living waking world and terrorizes the community. Now, where do we begin with this? So I guess, first of all, this film, one of the, looking at the rules of a sequel, it fucks completely with the original. That's it, right. Ignores the laws of the original and the rules and the world that was built up in the original, to the point where Wes Craven himself, first of all, he didn't want A Nightmare on Elm Street to be a franchise. Then when he was approached with this script, just could not at all put his name to it because he didn't believe it really followed anything that was created in the original and didn't feel it actually carried on anything or developed further for the storytelling. And he just really didn't want anything to do with it.
I think a generous assessment would be that the makers of the sequel, including the writer and the director, didn't necessarily understand what made the first one as popular as it was.
Yeah.
Now, the sequel, my understanding is that at the time it was quite a popular film, but, you know, it's been just short of 30 years since...
Yeah, this was released in 1985, and 84 was the original.
So 28 years later,
yeah.
You know, with the benefit of some hindsight, we can say that of that original run of Nightmare on Elm Street, this would be the weakest of the films.
Definitely. And
for reasons that it doesn't focus on those areas of the character and the narrative that has the most appeal, I think. Well, that would be a generous assessment.
Well, sort of to stack up a few bits and pieces. First of all, Freddy comes into the real world, that being that all of the key scenes and all of the kills actually happen in the real waking world. Yeah. There's actually no true dream sequence kills in any of this film. So they ignored that as a rule.
True.
Also, they fucked quite a bit with they fucked the film completely by turning the lead protagonist of a slasher film, which is traditionally a female, and made it a male. Yeah. Now, that we'll come back to because that plays a key role into why this is now the gayest horror film of all time.
Yeah. Also, they ignore that sort of... Well, what is considered a key tenet of the films is that the protagonists are the children of the vigilantes who killed Freddy Krueger.
Yeah.
Whereas this guy just sort of happens to share the room that Nancy used to live in.
Yeah, well, it's funny because they, in this film, everyone who actually dies has nothing at all to do with the Elm Street children. And they have nothing to do with the killing of Freddy himself. So there's no reason behind any of these deaths at all. They're people that are loosely connected to Jesse in some way, but in no way to Freddy himself.
I mean, Wes Craven's criticism of the film, which we saw as part of the bonuses, I think holds true in that the script is really just a vehicle for some very few spectacular scenes.
Yeah.
Also some like hilariously ridiculous and nonsensical scenes.
Yeah.
Many of them involving domestic pets.
Yeah, domestic pets and also chinaware too. Yeah. So I think the real victims in this film were, well, one, people that paid money to see it.
Yeah.
Two, were actually, if you were plates or chinaware.
Plates or chairs.
Or a family pet. Yeah. But so in this film, let's sort of go through the film.
All right,
the timeline.
Maybe best kill. I reckon
best kill.
Just to establish what the... Because there's not many kills in it.
No, there's not. And the first kill actually happens at about 35 minutes into the film.
It's actually a lot later than that into the film.
Was it?
I think it was more like 50 minutes.
Far out. I don't know. The gym teacher is...
Yeah.
So, yeah, we're waiting almost past the half hour point, at least about 45 minutes into the first before we actually see our first kill. Most spectacular kill, For me, I think it was the gym teacher, just because out there and ridiculous it was.
I don't know if you're going to play any clips, but it's an S&M themed... Well, the gym teacher is established as being into S&M actually in the first 10 minutes of the film.
Yeah.
Jesse finds himself in the S&M bar called Don's Place.
Yeah.
And it's inhabited by... I think actually the first shot is sort of a fairly, it's like a gay couple kissing and it's meant to be this like, oh, look at where you are.
Yeah.
And there's like punks and stuff and the gym teacher's in there. Inexplicably takes him back to the gymnasium to do laps.
Well, first of all, I want to know, why the fuck did he walk into Don's bar? Jesse, the whole film, there's this constant heat and oppression build up of how hot it is. So he goes for a walk in the middle of the night out in the rain. And then all of a sudden he sees Don's bar and walks in, place and walks in. Why?
I thought he was being influenced by the spirit of Freddy Krueger.
Ah, okay. So Freddy himself wanted to go to a gay bar. Is that what you're telling
me? I think the logic is that Freddy is slowly taking him over and he wants Jesse to become, cause you know, there's that opening, Freddy says, my brain, your body.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so he's wanting Jesse to become a killer.
Mm.
And so he's wanting him to choose victims that he's associated with as opposed to random people.
So he's slowly corrupting him by taking him to a bar and making him drink and things like that.
It's not immediately obvious, and this would be maybe the third or the fourth time I've seen the film.
Yeah.
And I think that's what is meant to be happening.
Now, well, actually, before we go into... Oh no, we'll continue on with the kills, and then we're actually going to go through and actually identify some of the real gay moments.
My favorite
kill. Do time with some of the kills. What's your favorite kill?
Exploding bird.
Exploding bird. Yeah. Why did the bird die?
Well, because fuck birds.
Okay.
I don't know. The scene is maybe. Again, I'm being generous. I'm not really sure why. Mm. Maybe I don't have a lot of generosity left in me for this film. But maybe it's sort of setting up this kind of nightmare logic, you know, where things don't necessarily make sense, but suddenly the familiar becomes threatening.
Yeah.
You know.
Wow. You're giving it depth I don't think it deserves, but sure. Yeah. Let's go with that.
Let's say that A Nightmare on Elm Street 2, / Freddy's Revenge, is a diamond with just one facet. There's not a lot to it, really, is there?
No, really not.
But, you know, it was hilarious, like... Not the most hilarious scene, but just when the bird explodes, it's so slapstick. And at no point did the birds attacking seem sinister or threatening. It seemed comical, but I don't think that was the intended effect.
Yeah, I did love that the bird exploded into flames in midair. And then the after shot of the family were them actually still looking up in the air. They weren't looking on the ground, obviously, where the remnants of said exploded bird would have fallen. Just shipwrecking there.
That's true.
But let's go a little bit earlier in the film and let's actually piece together what actually makes this a gay horror film. So early on in the film... Well, first of all, Jesse himself is played by... an actor named Mark Patton.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Patton just happens to be gay himself. And in my eyes, I don't believe he was quite able to pull off a straight character that well.
Yeah.
Though the character of Jesse was meant to be straight as far as the audience was aware.
Kind of.
We'll go into our reading of some of the directing, but...
Jesse was clearly struggling.
Yeah, he was struggling. He had issues.
Yeah.
But first of all, to have a male playing the lead of a role that's typically played by a female. So if you let's break down the gender aspect of slasher films. So with slasher films, you've often have the key female character who is turns from being the heroine who's running away and the survival girl who generally she is thought to be a virgin or virgin-esque in her behavior. So she doesn't go out slutting around. She doesn't take drugs and she's generally the, the key between a group of people often that wouldn't hang together.
Mm.
Now, this girl throughout the film is traumatized and terrorized and is constantly running away and just escaping the slasher. She does get to a point where through her running, she actually comes to a point where she goes, okay, to survive, I actually have to become a killer.
Mm.
And often she will take the weapon of the slasher to kill the slasher themselves. So basically she is taking his member to kill him.
So for the purposes of this podcast, we'll call that the penis.
The penis, yeah. So basically she is taking what he penetrates everyone else with, takes that on and penetrates him back.
Yeah.
So there's a certain reading, I guess.
Yeah.
Now, what happens when that's a boy?
Mm. Well, he screams a lot.
And he screams like a girl. He does have quite a high-pitched, girly-esque scream. But look, he may be having some really terrifying nightmares.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's interesting. He does, essentially, he's rescued by a woman.
Mm-hmm.
He seems to spend a lot of his time in a fraught relationship with a handsome young man.
Who and the man himself, first of all, they're not best friends. And that man is obviously a bit of a cool jock in school and would often be a little bit of the guy that would be bullying him because he does make fun of him early on.
Yeah.
So therefore builds up that relationship of, the guy that's bullying me turns in to be the one that he's then fascinated and builds that infatuation with.
I don't think Jesse is meant to be an intentionally effeminate character, but I think the, I think it's basically the limited vocabulary of the filmmakers that they basically just reverse genders but don't sort of really play with genders, if that makes sense.
So Jesse himself, he's constantly saved by a female.
Yeah.
Also, in the film, Freddy's interaction with him, all the other films, when you look at Freddy's relationship with the girls, he's always quite mean and rough with them.
Mm.
This one, he's actually rather delicate and gentle.
He's a bit tender.
He treats Jesse with some love and tender care.
I was going to say, there's a bit of a daddy-son type thing. A lot of sort of gentle grabbing of the face and...
Yeah, that's...
You know, you could be me.
That's
it.
let me teach you the ways, little boy.
Patronage, you know.
Very much so. Now, also, another thing I have to point out is all the kills in this film that aren't an animal or china and cutlery are actually men.
Men, yeah.
There is no killing of a female at all in this film.
No.
They are all... Well, men being killed and penetrated.
Well, there's the two women in the dream sequence, but you don't actually see them
be killed. We don't see them be killed. Yeah. He wakes up in that dream sequence, and that was the only one.
And he hides behind them.
And he hides behind them. Yeah. And that's the only one that was a dream sequence too.
Yeah.
So there's no real world connection to that at all. So the only kills that we see are all men.
So what are we left with when we see all of this stuff? You know, like what... It's just very obvious that the film writer has gone, you know, we want a gay themed film.
Was it obvious though?
I feel like it was. Like there's too much stuff in there to make you go, oh, that's a bit ambiguous.
But,
like the no chicks allowed, no out of town chicks sign on his door.
But
the scene, the wrestling scene where he's exposed. Yeah.
Early on, he gets his pants pulled down and we have his bare ass in shot. So therefore, his response is to then jump on top of said protagonist and start wrestling and trying to get his shirt off. That's when the gym teacher comes over and just stops and watches this action going on. So, yeah, that's rather interesting. Now,
I think Freddy is meant to be... And I'm not making this up. I think Freddy is meant to be... The terror of his sexuality.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's that ham-fisted, though.
But really, you're making a sequel to one of the most successful horror slasher films of the early 80s.
Yeah.
Who would put money behind that script and actually make that happen with such an obvious... surely that had to be disguised from... the backers of this film.
Maybe.
If it was that intentional.
I mean, you know, you could argue that the first film did a very good number in playing on typical teenage fears.
Yeah.
And that the people making the sequel tried to run with that theme, but basically not revisit the same dreamlike logic.
Okay.
So, you know, it's all, I think the reason why they want to put Freddy in the real world, because it was all about Jesse as the character being terrified to present himself as this horrendous thing. Right. And in no way am I saying that it's a progressive film or anything like that, because, you know, Freddy Krueger is like an ugly child raping murderer.
Yeah. And look, it was...
he's afraid that something along that continuum is on the inside. And,
yeah. Look, it was hardly a Brokeback Mountain of the horror film genre, that's for sure. Now, look, going through a little bit further in this film, we see Jesse unpacking in his room, and all of a sudden we have a dance montage of him unpacking his room to a rather girly, gay dance song. Now, look, it was the 80s, so that happens.
I do believe that was intentionally put in the film.
Yeah.
As a nod to Risky Business.
Yeah. Only, if Tom Cruise can do it, then...
Yeah. Only, you know, in Risky Business, you could argue that was quite a charming scene that establishes something about the character.
Exactly.
In this one, it definitely felt shoehorned in and was a little bit awkward.
And especially, he then puts on glitter glasses and then starts to gesture with a little BB gun that he's actually jacking off.
Yeah.
And it pops just as his mum walks in the room. It just didn't make sense as a scene, and just really, whether it was directed that way or it was just that Mark Patton really couldn't hide the fact that he was quite a screaming queen in that scene.
I suspect that maybe the reason why it was included was simply, this worked in Risky Business, we've got to get it in.
A bit of lighthearted fun.
Yeah. Or they might be trying to establish that is part of the nature of the character, and he's truly becoming traumatized by the Freddy Krueger.
Because we're going from the extremes.
Yeah. That's the end of my generosity. It's a fucking shit film.
So from there, we've got him going to Don's place, where all of a sudden you see his gym teacher turn up in a leather vest behind him. So he goes into Don's place, orders a beer.
Don's place is the S&M bar.
Is the S&M
bar. That's mentioned in the first 10 minutes of the film,
And then the gym teacher catches him there ordering a beer. And what else does he do but take him back to the school and make him do laps.
Yeah.
And then...
Yeah. Go to the shower.
And then, stop doing laps, go to the shower. In the meantime, the gym teacher, still in his creepy leather vest and sunburn tan, starts to have balls flying at his face. Literally has balls flying at his face.
Yeah.
And then jump ropes grab him around the wrist, drag him into the showers, and hook him up into the shower where his pants are ripped off of him by an invisible force, and his vest is ripped off as well.
Yeah.
This same invisible force...
We call that MDMA.
This same invisible force then whips his bare ass with towels, so gets whipped while he's tied up to the showers. And then at this point, we see Jesse disappear into the steam that is building up from the showers. Yeah. And then all of a sudden emerges Freddy, who then kills the gym teacher. This is our very first kill in the film. So.
And in fact, the only real kill of the film. I mean, there are kills in the party, but they're all sort of incidental.
Oh, no, we have one more real kill, which is the best, it's the main.
Oh, true.
Yeah. So, this is a rather homoerotic scene. I would say erotic, but...
Yeah. A homo scene,
Yeah.
Just two blokes who just happen to be sharing.
That's it. Nothing gay about it.
Yeah.
Well,
look, this might confirm my theory about Freddy being his... latent sexuality and his terror of his own sexuality.
Yeah.
You know?
Now, there was one scene in there which had an essence of true Nightmare on Elm Street. And both you and I actually said this when it came up. And that was where Jesse wakes in the middle of the night, walks through the house and opens up a door into a room where we see the skipping girl singing the Freddy tune.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's the only great scene of the film.
Yeah. It was beautifully shot. It had
well lit,
that real eerie, slightly overly drawn out singing as well. It wasn't just a slowed down. It was
nightmarish.
It was beautiful. And it's going, why? You obviously understand something about this world.
Yeah.
What the fuck? And that was it. All of a sudden, goodbye.
Yeah.
Goodbye to anything to do with Nightmare on Elm Street, and then back to some weird gay horror film.
Yeah, I'd be very interested in hearing an account of how that scene came about and what it was meant to establish in the film from the makers.
Now, we have the pool party that he goes to, and all of a sudden, in the pool house, he's there with his girlfriend, inverted commas, and she starts... she's obviously... she's getting hot and heavy. She wants some action. She obviously hasn't been getting any action up until this point. Yeah. And she's thinking tonight's the night.
Well, in fact, he's been like a little asshole for the previous 20 minutes.
Yeah.
From not sleeping, yells at her.
Yeah, and sulking. So I think they've only kissed once at this point. So all of a sudden, they start getting hot and heavy. And Jesse's way of getting hot and heavy with his girlfriend is rather interesting. He kisses her on the lips awkwardly and then starts to go down her neck and then grabs her breasts between his hands and then starts licking between the breasts, almost as if he was grabbing two gigantic butt cheeks with his hands and licking between of them.
I did think we commented at the time that, you know, who knew that it was possible to rim a pair of tits?
Yeah, that was it. The motion, the action that he was doing did look like he was trying to rim her tits, and he had his eyes closed. So maybe he was just trying to close his eyes and pretend that's what was actually happening. And
look, in fairness to Mark Patton, I think it's fairly safe to assume that he was being directed at this point. I mean, it was an odd scene.
Yeah, it was an awkward scene.
And, you know, as he's doing it, like, he sort of suddenly gets possessed by the spirit of Freddy Krueger again.
Yeah. And so
in the tongue form starts... of a giant blue tongue.
Yeah. So that's when he runs away and goes to his mate's house. So the next scene, all of a sudden...
Oh, my God. Well, this would be the one that establishes it as a gay film.
And so the next scene, all of a sudden, he's in his mate's bedroom. Don't know how he got in there. Just all of a sudden, he's in his mate's bedroom and wakes him up. So... his mate, Ron, is actually played by Robert Russler. Now, as a kid, I had the biggest crush on Robert Russler. And I think that was part of, as a kid, when I saw this scene, this is what I started to go, ooh, this is a little up my alley. Mm.
So to speak,
I wish. Mm. Robert Russler was also in a great vampire film called Vamp, which starred Grace Jones as a lead vampire. Such a crush on this man. Anyway, so all of a sudden he wakes up his mate and basically there is the line saying, some guy's trying to get in your body and you want to sleep with me.
Yeah.
Honestly, they just punch out gay line after gay line in this.
This is why I think it's intentional.
Yeah.
It's just not good.
No, it's fucking awful. So, there we go. That's our second kill in the film. And this is about an hour into the film. And we finally get our second kill. And that's where the mate dies in there. And then we go back to the pool scene. And this is where they just completely threw every lore of Freddy out the window. And Freddy appears at the pool party. Yes, he comes out of Jesse's body. But then all of a sudden... starts attacking people in the real world.
And China.
And plates and chinaware for some obscure reason. Plastic chairs also get a bit of a beating in this. But it's such a bullshit scene. It really makes no sense. And, like, I don't quite understand what the fuck they were trying to achieve
I think the other unfortunate impact that has on the film is that the film may have been slightly more interesting if Jesse at any point was made to be responsible for the things that Freddy Krueger was doing.
But he's not.
And this just firmly establishes that it's a supernatural event.
Yeah.
Which
people just manage to take in their stride in the film.
Well, yeah, like right at the end. Yeah, there's all of a sudden Jesse's skipping around. He's got bandages on from obviously where there's been wounds, but everyone's fine. Just going, ooh, jokes about this weird crazy party
where you got, you know, where we saw the guy get disemboweled by the ghost of a burnt child molester.
Yeah, and like, yeah, we see two guys actually get killed at the pool party. So there was two deaths at the pool party. The best friend just got killed and the teacher got killed, but yet, oh well.
Yeah.
So be it. So,
no biggie.
Yeah. So I guess, how do we sum up this film?
You know, all the kills were fairly, with the exception of the coach and the best friend.
Hmm.
Just look, it's a weightless film. It tries to say something, but no one cares.
Yeah, you know? Really. It is directing wise really rough and basic. It is appallingly edited, where there's just really jarring editing that sort of fuck with time sequencing.
Universally bad lighting through the film.
Yeah, well. There is. Also, the dogs with the baby faces. Oh,
the
faces.
Dogs with the baby faces.
Just why? Why?
It just happens.
Okay.
So there's a scene where I can't even remember the character's name. Meryl Streep.
Yeah, the lead girl who actually looks like Meryl Streep. Sorry, that was actually Kim Myers playing the lead girl. And
Lisa.
Lisa was the character name.
So Lisa is going to the old boiler factory. Yeah. What is it?
It's an electricity factory where Freddie used to work in the boiler room.
And so she walks in knowing that he's going to be there, and there are two dogs guarding the main entry. They inexplicably have children's faces, which is obviously just like a mask tacked onto a couple of
dogs.
And the effect is not as intended, it's just comical.
And look, I would understand if, one, we were in a dream sequence. Two, if that had any relevance to her as a character,
no.
Why would Freddy do that? And it doesn't,
And then there's sort of some more on-screen metaphors of the rat being attacked by a cat.
Yeah.
And there's the quick chop to the rat's face, which is this, like, hilariously bad puppet. And then there's another quick chop to the cat's face. Another weird puppet.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what we're supposed to take from this. There's a lot of abuse of domestic animals.
There really is.
There's the goldfish that get killed. There's the exploding birds. There's the baby-faced dogs. There's
the rats
cat with too many teeth.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then the rats.
What's going on? Disturbing. So,
maybe it's a comment on the nuclear family and domestication.
Oh, good call.
Maybe. Probably not.
Most likely not. Yeah. But look, let's give it that one because fuck knows it needs any help it can get.
Yeah.
So, well, look, I want to see your score out of 10 boob-rimming lead characters.
Oh, look. A Nightmare on Elm Street, 2 out of 10.
2 out of 10. Well, what do you give that 2 for?
There were elements of good. The special effects you can't really fault.
Yep.
I wouldn't say that it's the strongest Freddy Krueger makeup of all the films, but I still think they did a bang up job. So a lot of the practical effects were good.
Yeah.
I give it another star for at least, you know, look, they dug a dry well. but they did give it a shot, and I think there was some thinking behind it, but there was obviously a lot lacking in the execution.
Yeah.
So it's definitely the worst of the Elm Street franchise.
Yeah.
But, you know, look, it made an attempt.
Yeah.
So it's worse than average.
Yeah.
But better than some.
All right. Well, look, I'll give it 2.5 rimming boob jobs. That would be really for the two kills that we did see were actually well done. I did like both of those kills. As bizarrely gay as the gym teacher kill was, the actual slashing component I did enjoy. And and I guess just for the fact that we're here talking about it today as the gayest horror film, unintentionally or intentionally.
Intentionally.
We're yet to decide. So just for that fact, I'm going to give it that extra half. So campers out there listening, tell us what you think. Watch Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge, And let us know. Go on Facebook. It is a Horror Camp Podcast on Facebook. And let us know your thoughts. You can also give us feedback on Twitter. That is at Horror Camp at Twitter. So on Twitter. So thank you very much, Lee, for joining us today.
Not a problem.
And hopefully we'll have you back on camp soon.
Yeah, hopefully a good film.
Well, that's all we have time for here on Horror Camp. So thank you to my guests, Lee and Mike, for helping me out here on camp. And also, once again, thanks to all the support from the team at the Big Top Network for helping me out with this podcast. I look forward to hearing more of your feedback out there, and let me know what your thoughts are on this episode and if there's anything in particular you would like me to look into a little bit further as far as horror film favourites, whether they be seriously gritty or complete high camp. I love them all. I'll watch almost anything and give it a go. So thank you once again. If you do want to get in contact with this, you can head over to the Facebook page, which is Horror Camp Podcast on Facebook, and you can also follow us on Twitter, which is at Horror Camp. So that's all from me. I've been your host, Daniel, and I look forward to bringing the camp back to your horror soon.
Vampira.
Dracula.
Vampira.
Dracula.
Oh, Vampira.
Dracula.
Vampira.
Dracula.
Vampira.
Dracula.
Vampira.
Oh, Dracula.
Come, my darling, and fly away with me.
This podcast was brought to you by the Big Top Network.